It's going to take a while to figure out what happened with that crash. That does not help much, though, if you've got a flight coming up. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Monday today, the 11th day of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Aviation accidents are almost always complicated, and it can take months or usually longer to figure out what actually happened and why. So while we wait for the specifics of Ethiopian Flight 302 to become more clear, there are some very real concerns being raised by would-be travelers and airlines about the aircraft involved. As you know, it's the newest Boeing plane, the 737 MAX 8, the same model that crashed in Indonesia late last year. Southwest and American are among the U.S. carriers that fly it. Marketplace's Mario Segura looks at what this crash might mean for them.
When Stephanie Baliani heard about the Ethiopian Airlines crash, she thought about her daughter, Juliet, who's about to fly to Thailand.
I sent her a text this morning saying, Juliet, I need to find out what kind of plane you're flying to Beijing and then Thailand, because if it's a 737 MAX, we're changing your flight.
Baliani is 53 and lives in D.C. She owns an activewear company and travels a lot for work.
Now, it's one more thing to do. Check what kind of a plane you're on.
It's not clear yet why the Ethiopian Airlines flight crashed on Sunday, or if there is any problem with the Boeing 737 MAX 8. And regulators, like the FAA, will be looking into this. Danielle Kwesi Achekum is an aviation professor at the University of North Dakota.
We shouldn't jump into conclusion at this point. We should just wait for the investigators to come up with their recommendations based on facts.
The U.S. airlines that fly the plane, Southwest and American, say they stand behind the safety of their fleets, including the 737 MAX 8. But travelers are getting nervous. American Airlines says it won't be waiving its change fees for customers who refuse to fly on the jet. Southwest wouldn't disclose its policy. Richard Abulafia, an aviation analyst at the Teal Group, says any cancellations probably won't have a huge effect on the airlines. There are only 350 of these planes in the world. American Airlines has 24. Southwest has 34.
It's a relatively small number. So they're not going to lose business, I mean, just because of the relatively small number of flights serviced by these jets.
Stephanie Baliani, by the way, was relieved to hear that her daughter will not be flying to Thailand on the Boeing 737 MAX 8. I'm Marielle Segura for Marketplace.
One of the reasons the crash of Flight 302 has led to so much international concern about the MAX 8 is that Ethiopian Airlines isn't some small budget airline. It's big. It's well-respected. It's an international carrier with a history that goes back to the end of the Second World War. And as Marketplace's Ben Bradford reports, it is also arguably the most significant company in the Horn of Africa, both economically and culturally.
In the U.S., the president doesn't typically show up for an airport opening a new terminal. But that's what happened in Ethiopia in January. People celebrated as Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed cut the ribbon on the new international terminal at the Bole Airport in the country's capital, Addis Ababa, expanding Ethiopian Airlines' hub to about the size of Dulles Airport outside Washington, D.C. Abiy linked the airport's expansion with that of Ethiopia's economy, praising it but saying the country still has far to go. Ethiopia was sub-Saharan Africa's fastest-growing economy last year. It's trying to drive that growth through state investment, and the airline is its crown jewel. Analyst Craig Jenks likens Ethiopian in size to Canada's WestJet.
It is widely regarded as a well-run, well-managed, well-operated company.
The company's passenger count has quadrupled over the past decade. It has over 100 international routes, and its revenue is equivalent to almost 5% of Ethiopia's entire GDP. Economist Adugna Lemi at the University of Massachusetts says via Skype that it's not just the country's economy, but its national pride that's tied up in the airline.
If something happens, something like this, it is not considered just as some accident happened on some company. It's considered as the symbol of the country.
After yesterday's crash, Ethiopia's parliament immediately declared a national day of mourning. I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
Boeing shares, as you might imagine, had a rough day today, off 12% at the open, fought back to close down just a bit more than 5%. If, perchance, you glanced at the markets early today and then tuned out, as arguably you ought to do every day, You might have seen the Dow way down deep in the red. That's because the Dow is what you call a price-weighted index. The higher a company's share price, the bigger an impact it has on that index. Boeing is the most expensive stock in the Dow, going away $400 a share as of the close today. Any guesses, by the way, as to the second most expensive Dow company? It's all right. I'll wait. It's not Apple. Don't go there. It's not Goldman. Don't go there either. Anybody? 3M. Good old Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing. Anyway, quite a tidy finish on Wall Street today. Details, numbers, you know the drill. The White House is out with its 2020 budget proposal today. The word proposal is doing a whole lot of work there because Congress will almost surely ignore what the president and his advisors want and come up with its own plan to spend taxpayer money. $4.7 trillion, by the way, is the magic number for the Trump administration. Again, it's a presidential fiscal wish list, but it does give some insight into where this country spends money and where, increasingly, it can't. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more now from Washington.
President Trump's proposal calls for $2.7 trillion in spending cuts over a decade. Those cuts come from one part of the budget in particular, what's called non-defense discretionary spending.
A whole host of items that are sort of basic government functions.
Seth Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress.
Everything from aviation security to law enforcement to the National Weather Service.
Education, infrastructure, basically everything that's not the military or mandatory spending like Social Security, Medicare, interest on the national debt. Back in the 1970s, that mandatory spending was only about a third of the budget, and Congress could decide how to spend the other two-thirds.
And now it's completely the reverse, where basically the part that's discussed in our overall budget is a very small part.
Veronique DeRuggi at the Mercatus Center says the share of the budget going to things like education or housing programs is down to about a third, leaving Congress to argue over how to spend a steadily shrinking portion of federal revenue.
Imagine like very hungry dogs and you give them less food each time to fight over, and they can't quite agree on how to spend that money.
And that piece of meat keeps getting smaller because, says Justin Bogie at the Heritage Foundation, the share going to mandatory spending, the items basically on auto pay, keeps getting bigger.
And that's simply because the cost of things like healthcare programs is becoming so great that there's just less and less of the budget to go around.
Those costs will keep growing along with the national debt and its interest payments.
You know, sometime in the next 15, 20 years or so, we're going to be to the point that just Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and interest on the debt will actually consume all federal revenues.
At least according to current projections. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
One would not, in ordinary conversation, call a bank branch office a cool place to be. Business models, however, are not ordinary conversations, and thus, here we are, talking about no less an old line bank than J.P. Morgan Chase playing the cool card in Washington, D.C. Why? Well, first of all, demographics is destiny, and also because after years of trying, Chase has finally been cleared to set up shop in the nation's capital. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains what's going on there.
With its first branch in D.C., Chase is trying hard to be young and hip. There's modern furniture and lighting. The only two teller windows are hidden in the back behind sliding doors. John Eric Wilson is the branch manager. He says around two-thirds of the bank's customers are millennials, like himself.
They can relax on the couches. They can plug into the chargers on the tabletops. This is the space that is the most comfortable for that.
Wilson points to what's known as the family room. That's separate from the branch's three living rooms. There are also so-called restaurant booths along the sidewalk where customers can get financial advice. Wilson is wearing the bank uniform, jeans, a button-down shirt, and a name tag that says, "I'm saving for a house." He says all this is designed to make talking about money less stressful for young customers.
We want them to be able to come in when they need advice, and we want to be there to help them grow and to be part of their financial journey.
Yeah, Chase and every other traditional bank. But here's what they're up against. A whole generation of Ruche Elamines. Elamine, who's 34, came into the Chase branch to replace her lost ATM card. Otherwise, she does her banking online.
Then I don't have to come into the branch and walk in the cold or use my lunch break to come into the branch.
Whatever brought her in, branch manager John Eric Wilson is just glad she's here. Because even a lost ATM card can lead to a conversation that can lead to bigger things. That conversation used to be a lot easier. Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School says for years, the conversation started right out of school or with a first job.
Here's your credit card. Would you like us to help you refinance your student loan? Would you like us to help you think about planning for your retirement?
But now banks are up against much stiffer competition from online lenders. Personal loans made by traditional banks dropped by about a third in the past 5 years, in part because more consumers were turning to online banks. That's according to a TransUnion study. Andrew Hovid is with Novantas, a marketing firm for big banks. He says flashy new branches can give them an edge.
Making sure that you have some locations that are in kind of marquee locations around town where you're able to kind of build and burnish your brand.
Chase plans to open up to 70 new branches in the Washington region. Capital One Bank recently opened one of its cafes in Washington. They serve Pete's Coffee and have charging stations. Capital One will open a second cafe in Georgetown, just a couple of doors down from a branch Chase is now building. I nabbed 29-year-old Adam Steele on the sidewalk outside.
I think I would go and use the charging station.
Steele says he does like the idea of interacting with someone face-to-face at a bank, but unless his phone battery is dying, Steele would rather go to a traditional bank branch. He's more comfortable with an old-fashioned loan officer than a roving associate in jeans. Perhaps that's because of his general mistrust of banks. He came of age during the financial crisis.
Many of my friends endured hardship, had to take on tremendous amounts of student loans, especially my own father lost his job during the financial crisis.
Still, a bank is a bank, and its biggest draw is the perks on its credit cards or higher interest rates on savings accounts. That's what really matters to Steele. He is a Capital One customer because it offered him the best interest rate. And all the throw pillows and charging stations in the world won't help banks compete for customers like him if they don't have that. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Coming up.
If you want to get paid white-collar wages, then you better be prepared to work like a blue-collar worker.
Not a bad mantra for the entrepreneurs among us, eh? But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 200 points today, 0.7%. That's after being down 242. Remember, I told you it's a price-weighted index. Blue chips closed at 25,650. The NASDAQ gained 149 points, 2%. Finished at 75.58. The S&P 500 climbed 40 points, 1.4%, 27.83. Boeing, we told you about, down more than 5% at the close today. European rival Airbus gained 1.2%. Airline stocks kind of mixed today, actually. Delta climbed more than 3%. JetBlue gained 2.6%. United, almost unchanged, down just a hair. Southwest, off about a third of 1%. Tesla, and I miss this, it rolled back plans to close its stores and raise prices on most of its models after saying it was going to close the stores and cut prices. Anyway, finished the day 2.3% higher. GM up about 1.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.64%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Look. Payday's awesome, but running payroll, calculating taxes and deductions, staying compliant, that's not easy. Unless, of course, you have Gusto. Gusto is a simple online payroll and benefits tool built for small businesses like yours. Gusto gets your team paid while automatically filing your payroll taxes. Plus, you can offer benefits like 401k, health insurance, and workers' comp. Just for listening today, you also get 3 months free. Go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There are more kids in this economy today, says the Centers for Disease Control, dealing with chronic illnesses than there used to be. And that means there are more kids showing up at school while dealing with chronic conditions. And that, in turn, puts a huge load on school nurses, a problem that is especially acute in the more rural parts of this country. Maine's a real good example. Nurses there often have to travel to reach students spread across several schools. So some districts down east are looking for more money and more nurses to ease the workload. Maine Public Radio's Robbie Feinberg has that one.
The kids begin flowing into Nurse Maxine Perret's office early on this Monday morning at Etna Dixmont Elementary School in rural Penobscot County, Maine. The students have nausea, rashes, a nosebleed.
Squeeze hard. Squeeze hard. Give me that. That a girl.
Perret is only at the school 2 days a week. She works at two other schools the rest of the time. So there's a lot she's got to do in just a few hours. Perret shows me several cups inside her medicine cabinet, stocked with pills assigned to students.
You have these kids who have crises, whether it's a mental health crisis, and they take meds to help manage that, and they have a lot of difficulties and challenges at home. They don't have food, they don't have heat, they don't know where they're going to be, they don't know who's going to be there when they get home.
The school is dozens of miles from most medical services, making the nurse's office often feel like a little emergency room, she says. Nina Fakaris, the president of the National Association of School Nurses, says the job isn't what much of the public imagines.
I think the average person thinks that the school nurse is someone who sits in a little office, puts Band-Aids on boo-boos when kids come in, you know, with scraped knees from the playground, maybe an ice pack, gives them a hug.
But she says that's not the case today. According to the CDC, rates of diseases like diabetes and epilepsy have surged in children over the past few decades. Mental health needs have increased. Yet a 2018 study in the Journal of School Nursing found that less than 40% of schools employ full-time school nurses. Again, Fakaris.
We're often on our cell phones talking to secretaries and school staff about issues and crises that are happening at the school, so we're kind of trying to triage over the telephone.
In Maine, the burden is particularly heavy in rural and high-poverty areas. Plus, there's a statewide nursing shortage that's projected to grow to 3,000 nurses by 2025. University of Maine nursing professor Kelly Strout says some parts of the state with the worst health outcomes often have the fewest school nurses. Strout describes one tiny coastal school district near the Canadian border, where a nurse covers 7 school buildings and only visits each once a month.
The issue is so clear that there's just resource disparity across the state, but it's just how do you fix it? You know, how do you level it out, especially when it comes to our health?
Maxine Perret says in her district, it's had to become a team effort to handle the added burden. Administrative assistants often pick up the slack and distribute medicine. The school also trains everyone from custodians to bus drivers, even some students, on how to administer CPR and first aid. But that can all still leave gaps in care. That's led organizations like the American Academy of Pediatrics to advocate for full-time nurses in every school building. Yet schools still have to compete with better-paying institutions. Nationally, the average RN in a hospital made around $72,000 in 2017. Those in schools made about $16,000 less. Superintendent Mike Hammer, who runs a rural district in Maine, says he sees few nursing applicants.
Presently, we have a behavioral specialist that we're looking for. We're looking for a speech therapist. We are looking for a nurse. We've gone through 3 or 4 nurses in the last 3 years that I've been here.
Some schools are now looking towards new models they hope will help, like sharing school nurse costs with local hospitals. But so far, those efforts are mostly few and far between, leaving schools to try and fill in the gaps. In Penobscot County, Maine, I'm Robbie Feinberg for Marketplace.
We'll be right back. The 2010 census put the population of New Plymouth, Idaho at 1,538. So it's a small town, an hour or so northwest of Boise. And we're talking about it basically because it's not New York or San Francisco or Los Angeles. It's not a place you hear about all the time as being great places to start a new business. And yet, New Plymouth is for a particular slice of the market in this digital age of retail. Jessie Roberts founded her company. It's called Cheekies in New Plymouth. It's apparel and accessories brands for rural women. And it is now a multi-million dollar online enterprise. Her book about her life and her business in rural America is called Backroads Boss Lady. Jessie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
When you started in New Plymouth and you set up that boutique, what were you setting out to do?
Well, I think that a lot of people have these super inspirational why stories and what their why is. But the truth is that I wanted to feed four kids.
Yeah.
Like that was why I started the business. I had kids to feed and I had a very small amount of money. I didn't want to sell cars anymore. I didn't want to own a laundromat. But whether I enjoyed it or not, I was there to pay the bills.
The store is originally handbags, accessories, clothing for rural women. Do me a favor, for those who are listening to this, and honestly me included, who might not understand that market segment, what was your business?
Well, originally, I actually started, don't judge me, a tanning salon.
Well, right.
Because I thought—
I was going to get there, but yeah.
Yeah, I thought that people would want that. And I bought a handful of handbags and some jewelry. And the first thing that sold was all of that, and no one was tanning. So I was like, all right, well, we're going to sell these tanning beds and buy some more stuff. Hmm. And then it just got to the point where I wanted to have something different, and I started to realize that the majority of the items that were sold to women who lived in the country, you know, farm girls, ranchers, just anyone who lived a more outdoor, down-to-earth kind of lifestyle— all of those things were being designed in Asia. So they didn't sometimes make sense. And so I wanted to figure out, how can I make these products more authentic? Mm-hmm. So I started designing my own products.
And you have become now a woman running a plus or minus $10 million enterprise, right?
Yes.
You have an international supply chain. You
are— we're working on a distribution center in Australia.
I know. So holy cow.
Literally.
Well, yeah. I guess the question is, when did you make that transition from selling things in a little rural boutique in New Plymouth, Idaho, to a brand and an enterprise?
You know, every day I had to grow just a little bit. We very quickly outgrew the infrastructure that our town could handle. We outgrew the electricity, the phones, the cable, the weight of our product, actually. And our equipment was too heavy for most of the late 1800s buildings.
Oh, wow.
So we've had to replace floors, everything, you name it.
Yeah.
So I just let it grow naturally and stayed content in where I was.
Could you take a minute and explain what it's like to try to compete from rural America with a lot of the big urban brands? Who, in a lot of ways, don't have your best interest at heart.
I think that that is a struggle that I have every day,
yeah.
Not only in the business, but personally. You know, I'm oftentimes told, you're not big enough, you're not small enough, you're not country enough. I have this saying that is, if you want to get paid white collar wages, then you better be prepared to work like a blue-collar worker.
Huh.
And so I had to be willing to do what other people wouldn't. And that was working.
Are you getting the white-collar wages now?
I am providing white-collar wages for a lot of other people, and that's what's really important to me.
Jessie Roberts, the book is called Backroads Boss Lady. The company is called Cheekies. You can find it online. Jessie, thanks a lot.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
This final note on the way out today, this one is for everybody whose kids didn't sleep last night or who drove to work in the dark or to whom the idea of just arbitrarily changing the clock seems dumb. Anyway, from the president's Twitter account today, it's been a while since we quoted him on Twitter, huh? Anyway, this tweet, quote, "Making daylight saving time permanent is okay with me!" Exclamation point. First of all, he's right, it is saving, not savings. Also, not a terrible idea. Don't at me. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 200 points today, 0.7%. The phrase of the day, by the way, the market phrase of the day, once again, say it with me, price-weighted. The NASDAQ up 149 points, 2%. The S&P 500 gained 40. That is 1.4%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shen. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.